Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm honored to be joined by a very senior and accomplished professional, and as he so kindly reminded me, a very, very old friend, Mr. Sandeep Das from India. Sandeep, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh. What a pleasure. I mean, long time to catch up, but we have finally.
Absolutely. Sandeep is a board director. He's the former CEO and a strategic thinker. He is India's first private licensed telco CEO with Hutchison Max Telecom. He's been with the Maxis Group and was the group CEO and board director. He was the managing director and CEO of Reliance Jio Infocom, and he has been amongst the 100 most powerful people in telecom globally for 4 years between 2009 and 2013. Wow, what an amazing journey, Sandeep. And before we start talking telecom, tell me about your own journey as a professional.
Well, I started right after doing my mechanical engineering. I was all of 20. Mm-hmm. When I joined DCM in the famous or infamous management training scheme. So in those days, you either got into ITC or Hindustan Lever or DCM or Tata Administrative
Service. Absolutely.
Anyway, so I worked for their consumer durable group, which was Usha International. And it was one of the, it was a great learning ground because the management training scheme itself was a sort of an MBA of sorts. And we learned a lot about the business at a very tender age. Thereafter, I went across to Dubai, and I worked for Toyota Motor Corporation's franchise, Al-Futtaim Motors. And I simply loved automobiles, and I thought that will be my life all through. I had the added honor of being asked by the company that I needed to drive a new car every week.
Which was not a bad
thing to be
assigned. Absolutely.
I got kind of used to the smell of fresh leather. So and then I was also fortunate that I was part of the team that launched Lexus worldwide in 1990, and that was a great experience because here was a absolutely outstanding firm like Toyota, which taught me things like quality standards, planning, to the kind of rigor that one hadn't seen in many other companies. And DCM was very structured, but Toyota was even further down the line.
Correct.
And Lexus was a luxury car, and you can see how the company reinvented itself. Thereafter, in 1993, I came back into India. Briefly, I was parked very funnily in a company which was selling semiconductors, which was the Max Group. Little did I know that they were actually plotting to set me up for telecom business because in those days, the telecom licenses were in court. And then one fine day, I walked in, I met this Chinese gentleman who looked very, very gaunt. And he said, you know what, you are now going to be Mr. Paging for us. So in 1994, I started India's first paging company. And that's how I became India's first private telecom CEO.
Amazing. Because
before that, everything else was government run. And then and thereafter, we went into cellular in 1994, 95. And then the rest, as they say, is history. I was in Hutchison Telecom, launched Orange, launched Hutch. You know, that famous pug ad was done during my regime. And then I went across to Malaysia, where I headed a large Malaysian telecom group called Maxis. Took the company for the largest IPO in telecom in those days. We raised $3.9 billion. And thereafter, I went to work very, very closely with Mukesh Ambani. And there were two very joyful years. And then at the age of 57, I decided I'd go back to US to study because I wanted to do my PhD and I wanted to always teach. And but I ended up doing my AMP at Harvard Business School. And I came back and then I started unsuccessfully a private equity company. After that, ever since that, I've been on boards and I've been mentoring people.
Fantastic. What an amazing journey. And there's so much to talk to you about. But let's talk a little bit about telecom now, Sandeep.
Sure.
You were amongst the forerunners when the utility was being privatized. What are some of the changes that you have seen in the world of telecom over the last 2 decades?
But I think the changes have been phenomenal. Let me give you a context, Ashutosh. When I started telecom in 94, 95, we were about 950 million people.
Correct.
And India had all of 6 million fixed line phones. Don't ask me how we called for our driver, fetch children from school. I would presume that 60 to 70% of that those fixed lines were either in the government or institutions or very affluent homes. And that's where we started. And ever since that, when you say the changes in telecom, I would put it in two contexts. One is the changes in telecom by virtue of what happened globally. And the other one, which what happened in India. I mean, India changed completely with the advent of mobility, and you know that better than anybody else. When we got our first 100,000 customers, we celebrated with laddus, and now we are doing 100,000 every hour, perhaps. And the world. I remember there was a very famous book written by Cairn Cross, which was called The Death of Distance, and that's exactly what happened. So when you look at mobility with its miniaturization, with its digital facet, with the fact that it covered grounds which were otherwise very difficult to lay fibers on, it really shrunk India.
Correct.
And which is why we saw an economic boom of a different kind. I would sort of attribute mobility to a great deal for the kind of strides we took as a nation. In the meanwhile, I feel from the first time that we actually started business, where we were still seen as, this is still very much the territory of the government and the state, and what are these private guys doing? Pretty much like the kind of debate you'd have if you wanted to privatize railways, for example.
Correct,
But
correct.
so these people were, so I would say that enormous changes in regulation. At the time when we bid for licenses way back in the 90s, there were every conceivable telephone company in the world was in India. Everybody. And they all shrunk down to now about two and a half, three and a half players. I call them
Correct.
three and a half because BSNL comes in and goes out. So
Absolutely.
therefore that has shrunk. The amount of the way that the generational change has happened in the regulatory environment, the way that the state has been promoting telephony, the way in which applications and content has been layered on this, it's just fascinating. And most importantly, I think it is amazing to see how inexpensive mobility is in our country. And here I would like to give credit to the operators who have really sacrificed a lot of their margins and put the cart before the horse in a sense and said that, look, let's put the telephone in the hands of people and let's make it affordable.
Correct.
And then we will see what happens to the business case.
Absolutely. And I remember when I came back from Singapore in 96, and Bharti had just launched Airtel. The cost in those days of BSNL was 42 rupees a minute to call Bombay and
Yes.
84 rupees a minute to call outside India, but wonderful.
There was a time when your incoming calls were 16 rupees a minute. And then the very, very seminal 1990, NTP policy came in, which changed it. And of course, it has gone through several iterations. And now,
Correct.
in its current form, you can't recognize the original policy.
Absolutely.
Because remember, at that time, we were still dealing with the Indian Telephone Act of 1889, which was set up by the British, which, by the way, talked about privatization as far back as the 1889.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. So, your response about 3.5 players left. I mean, that's a great segue to my next question. We've got Reliance, Bharti, and Vodafone, three major players left, and BSNL. What is as a senior former telecom professional, what do you see for the future?
You see, a duopoly is not tenable in a country, in any country for that, irrespective of the size. And I think one of the roles of the state and the regulator is to ensure that it's free and fair market practice and that consumerism actually, in a sense, overrides monopoly. So even a duopoly is unacceptable. That can get into a very cozy relationship. So therefore, they are constantly looking at how to make the third or the fourth player equally formidable, so that choices are available. So I see constantly companies going belly up, and then the companies never go away. They come back in another form. So therefore, I don't see this becoming 10 players or 11 players at this point of time. However, I must say, you remember, you know, Ashutosh, there used to be a little toy in our young days which used to punch and it would spring back.
Yeah.
So that's how the sick companies will behave in time. But there will always be them. I think the important thing is that I see, and I hope I am right, that with such a vast subscriber base, and with the expanse that is there to cover the territory and the country, I think a lot of these smaller MVNOs would perhaps in the future be the right recipe for India, for the simple reason that we are many countries and we are many cultures and we are many segments. So you have a large number of younger people, but you don't have a small number of older people either. So whether it is dealing with the senior citizens or the younger people or the women, etc., I start seeing that the larger operators will perhaps become the mother platform. And a number, and there'll be a sprinkling of a lot of smaller regional plays, all under the umbrellas of the larger network. So the big boys will do the network and the smaller ones will create customized products and stuff like that. And of course, one will see a proliferation of data packages.
Correct. Because
the world is internet. So that's where data is going to become very, very critical.
Correct. Correct. And you seem to be answering all my questions before I ask them. But my next question relates to data, Sandeep. And, you know, everyone's saying data is the new gold rush or the new oil. How do you think so much data? I mean, I don't know how many, you know, billion terabytes or whatever the number is being generated every minute, probably. How will this huge amount of data be used or mined?
See, right now we really have data coming out of our ears. I
Correct.
The difference is that simultaneously, you know, one of the things that I read somewhere was that technology is moving so fast that we are finding it very difficult to comprehend with it and to deal with it because it's moving faster than us.
Correct.
But the fact is, technology is also simplifying things to an extent where you don't have to really, you know, Dr. Bhava once said that when you're backward, the advantage is you can always catch up in real time. So that's what's happening today for us. But if you look at the profusion of data, big data analytics and all those kind of things are also proliferating by the side because people are struggling with how to deal with so much data. I think the biggest change that we will see with data is not only the mining of the data, Ashutosh, but perhaps getting into stronger predictive models. You know, there are patterns that you can pick up. One thing is to react to data, which is what is happening today. But the other thing is to predict what will happen looking at how data is moving. And that's where the fascinating part of data will happen. And I can see a lot of work happening. I can't see a single company or a bunch of large companies doing it, but I see a number of startups, smaller units. Again, like I was going back to the MVNO example, a lot of people occupying tiny niches and doing things. But there is also a lot of garbage in and garbage out.
Correct.
So you have
Correct.
To be very careful that you don't indulge in generating even more information than is required to be absorbed.
Well
or more importantly, acquired to be acted upon. So things in the areas of weather, climate, health, now those are the areas where a lot of the predictive form of data could become extremely, extremely useful. And you know, like I was telling somebody the other day that, you know, like in business plans, it's not about what the future will hold for you, but what you predict for the future.
Correct. Amazing. So now let me move on, Sandeep, and ask you a few questions on your being an independent director. You know, there are always questions relating to, should I accept it? What are my fiduciary responsibilities? And I personally, for example, have stopped accepting all board positions. And in fact, I've stepped off most boards because I said at 66, I don't want to take on any more fiduciary responsibility. But I want to ask you, My first question is, what do you look for before you accept a board role?
Well, I let me say that, Ashutosh, your concerns regarding an independent director's role and the fiduciary responsibility and the penalties that come with it are very, very onerous.
Right.
And I think most of us struggle with that, and we're hoping that the guidelines and the regime and the regulators will be kinder to independent directors, not for any other reason, but because of the fact that the window of information, opportunity, and diligence that is available to independent directors, the outcomes that are expected from them are really unfair and very, very skewed.
Correct.
And that's really the concern. Nothing else is the concern, because I'm sure when you say, what do you look for in a company? Of course, we look for being associated with the company where you can grow and they can grow as well.
Absolutely.
I don't accept something where I feel I cannot impact an organization. Although we know that in many cocktail parties and all, people will tom-tom the companies they are on boards of, they go, and for both the board as well as for the person, these are trophies. But there's no actual work.
Absolutely.
So, you get papers 2 hours before the board, nobody ever reads it. Half the time they're listening to whatever the CEO is saying, and then they go back very happily, they're wined and dined, and they're back. So due diligence is very, very critical. So I think I would go in for a company which is where I can impact, where I can also commit. And Ashutosh, I must tell you that I have taken in very few board assignments, primarily because if I don't commit 15 to 20 man days to a board, walking down the corridors of their factories and understanding their business and taking part in their strategy, etc., I will not accept a board
Yes.
blend. Now, what goes without saying is that the company must be above board in terms of its
Correct.
standards of fiduciary standards and principles. And I think the other thing is also the culture. Is this a board that is putting up numbers, or is this a board that's genuinely looking for help? Because having run businesses myself, I have to be constantly careful, Ashutosh, that I don't put on the operational hat,
Absolutely.
because then I can be absolutely a painful director on the
Yeah,
board. But
yeah.
the thin line. But at the same time, having been in operations and having run boards, I can empathize with some of the issues which the operating team needs quick disposal of matters and insight and help from the board. And I think I so therefore I it's very important to meet people who have been board members already, meet former board members actually. And more than meeting present board members, you should always meet former board members, particularly those who have left. And the vendors of the company, those are the people who will, when suppose the company is sort of unable to pay money, the first person they'll squeeze is the vendor, and the vendor will tell you what's happening. So I think, but there is also a limit, Ashutosh, to what you can do in this respect. You also have to go by other track records, analyst reports, this, that, etc. It's a lot of hard work actually before
I
you accept.
agree. I agree.
But like you, let me tell you that I'm also inclined towards doing what you're doing, which is to say, do I need this at this stage?
I know.
Because the environment is not making it easy for you.
Correct, correct. And one of the things that I've started doing, Sandeep, is that I say I'm happy to be associated, but as an advisory board member,
Oh,
not an
absolutely. That's what I
executive
do.
board. Huh.
That's what I do.
Wonderful.
I love advisory roles because you can actually impact a lot more.
Correct.
More than anything else, you don't even have to be politically correct.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. Well said. My next question is that, you have served, in China with Malaysian companies, large, you've been involved with large American companies. What are some of the governance standards in boards that you have worked with that you think are now being implemented or need to be implemented in Indian boards?
I sat on a, when I look at various boards I've been on, including Indian boards and boards in Malaysia and boards in Singapore, etc., I was very, very pleasantly surprised with the kind of governance standards that exist in Singapore and in Malaysia. You've seen that yourself. They are very, very, very disciplined. They are very, very, they stick to the book in terms of guidelines. They're very particular about submissions and all that. They're not, what I say, economical with the truth. And I think in India, a number of companies are doing that, but a number of companies have a long way to go. The good part is, I mean, I can only talk about the companies that I am associated with. The good part is that even if they have miles to go to get to that stature, the important thing is that the intent is right. They want to get there. And I think I would say that there is a gap that exists between the international firms and us. And it's also got a lot to do with the stature of people that put on boards.
Correct.
I mean, I, for example, remember one of the companies that I was working with, the audit chairman was always somebody of the level of chairman of one of the big four globally. So you can see that that was the kind of importance that they attached to something like an audit committee, that the board came 3 days before and met the entire CX. So all these things are a bit unheard of in India at this point.
Well said, well said. And my last question to you, Sandeep, and this is for the many, many people who will listen to our conversation. Based on your own amazing journey and all the learnings that you've had, what would you say are three lessons you would want our viewers and listeners to take away from your journey and from our conversation?
That's a very hard one, because anytime somebody asks me for your top three, top five, top one, I get very nervous. Because
okay, we'll remove the number.
For the simple reason that there are so many, Ashutosh, you know that. There are so many. And seldom do individuals sit down and say, okay, let me do a pecking order of what are the top three, what are the top four. But yes, but I know why you're doing that in the interest of time and to make sure that people do what... I have found that there are some things that I do, and this is true of most individuals. We do it, but what is naturally what comes to us naturally. I mean, people have often talked about something called authentic leadership, and I said, "What is that authentic?" I've always been authentic. So when you know, people use trendy terms, etc. But you know, if I were to look at the stuff that for me, integrity has been, it is constantly challenged, but you know, you have to hold on to it, like Pericles held on to Achilles's mother on the seashore of Styx. You just, in spite of its changing form, that's very, very critical. It's very, very important to be respectful and to be humble and not get ahead of yourself. But at the same time, it's very important to be irreverent to anything that is thrust upon you as an idea. So, curiosity is really, to my mind, if I would send out a message to the youngsters, that curiosity has to be your second nature. I know it has to be very important. I mean, I've been completely, I mean, you've met so many people at very, very high levels of this world, entrepreneurs, this, that, and I've worked with Nika Singh, with Mukesh Ambani, with Ananda Krishna, and lots of big, big people, Jack Welch, and they all are people who were incredibly curious.
Correct.
Incredible, and never sort of, you sometimes collapse with the kind of questions they ask. And I think people, I have found to my horror that trust is an important factor, but you must trust and verify. And there is a very, very thin line between abdication and delegation. And,
correct.
You know, and that's really where I think good CEOs and all are able to, you know, there's the famous Buddhist middle path. You know, you'll be able to find the right balance between what is being done. I think it's important at all points of time, I feel, to, and this is something was said to me very early in my life, and is to work with companies as if it's your own, and to be completely, completely not drawn into salaries, money, ranks. They are all byproducts. I mean, I've actually been surprised with some of the favors that have come to me in that direction, because they've come before time, but I have never sort of lusted after those, and that's kept me whatever. And finally, I would say that from my own mistakes, I would say that I talked about trust and verification, but I would say that I wish, you know, I did not think that I lived my life as if I had another body in the bank. I would have been a lot more fitter, healthier. And I think people tend to ignore that when they are young. And when you get older, you know, it's that old soldier's wounds come up. And I think it also leads to strong mental fitness and being agile, you know, knowledge. And, you know, in youngsters, I would say that, you know, in the future, there'll be just two kinds of companies, those that are digital and those that are dead. And knowledge has become such an important adjective.
Correct.
And particularly technical knowledge. Nobody, whether in any area of the company or any area or any kind of business, can ignore technology.
Absolutely.
And putting your grasping technology is very, very important. And the good part is that you can grasp. You don't have to know the nuances of doing things, but you can understand what technology can do for you.
Absolutely. Well said. Well said. And on that note and your amazing lessons, hold on to your integrity, be respectful and humble, have curiosity. It has to become a second nature, trust and verify. And what you said was very interesting, that there is a very thin line between abdication and delegation. Thank you, Sandeep, for speaking to me. Thank you for talking to me about your incredible journey, about how you got into telecom and all the stuff that you achieved in telecom. Thank you also for talking to me about your board directorships and some of the precautions you take and a lot of people should consider taking before they really accept fiduciary responsibility. Thank you again for reconnecting after so many years. And I look forward to staying in touch. Thanks.
I'm so grateful. It was a wonderful chat. You know, a chat is good when you know you don't want it to end. And thank you so much, Ashutosh. And it's been a pleasure finally attaching your face to the name. And I look forward to catching up with you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast. Platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.